Welcome to Wall Street Unspun with your host, Peter Schiff.
But it's a giant bubble in search of a pin, and it's going to find
one. Are you confused with the ups and downs in the economy and what it means to you?
Don't believe the propaganda, and that's what it is. When you're listening to an analyst on a lot of these popular financial shows, you're not getting investment advice. You're getting propaganda.
Get ready to untangle the web of misinformation provided by the mainstream media.
These firms are trying to sell you stocks. Their real clients, their banking clients, are trying to get rid of stuff.
And now, here's your host of Wall Street Unspun, the president of Euro Pacific Capital and a licensed broker with a passion for truth. It's Wall Street Unspun with Peter Schiff.
This is Peter Schiff coming to you live on Christmas Eve 2008. I'm taking your calls at 888-678-9597, 888-678-9597. I guess this is a special Christmas Eve Hanukkah edition of Wall Street Unspun, the midweek market update. I do the show live every 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific on my website, www.europac.net, EUROPAC.net, and on shortwave radio, 5.07 megahertz. Anyway, not too much has happened during the week. I think it's been a relatively quiet week as far as news items are concerned. I did a little bit more TV. You know, I've been doing Kudlow and Company on CNBC now. You know, I hadn't been on that show for a year and a half, and all of a sudden they're starting to invite me back on again. And in fact, I think I'm going to be on again either Monday or Tuesday. I'm not sure. I think it'll one of those 2 days. When I know for sure, I'll put it up on my website. But either Monday or Tuesday, I'll be on it. It's on CNBC. It's they're calling it CNBC Reports right now, but it airs from 7 to 8 p.m. And I guess if I do it long enough, one of these days I'm going to have to be on with Art Laffer again, because I know Art Laffer is on quite often. So it'll be interesting when I try to, you know, hit him up for my penny and my note, what happens. But I'm sure a lot of people would like to see Art Laffer and I on Kudlow again, because that, you know, part of that Peter Schiff Was Right video, the very first interview was from Kudlow and Company when I was on with Art Laffer. Now, Larry Kudlow wasn't there. Maria was guest hosting Cabrera. But it'd be interesting. I mean, so far I haven't been on them, although I was on, I mentioned last week on the show, I was on again with Don Luskin. Never a very pleasant thing to be, to happen. But anyway, we'll see if I come up with Art Laffer again. But anyway, as I know, Monday or Tuesday of this coming week, I'll be on. But, you know, there continues to be a lot of talk about all the ways that the government is going to stimulate the economy, the way the government is going to get the economy going, that it's okay to print a lot of money because there's all this excess capacity. There are people who are losing their jobs, and, you know, we need the government. The government can print money, and it's not going to create inflation because there's this excess capacity. And therefore, you know, the government needs to put people to work who are unemployed, or it needs to spend money that no one else is spending. And all, again, all this is just this nonsense Keynesian view of the world, that if the government doesn't employ people, that people are going to remain unemployed. That's just not true. I mean, people are going to get jobs. Now, wages might have to fall, which is, you know, an unfortunate consequence. But, you know, when you don't have a lot of capital, you can't pay high wages. I mean, the reason that American workers earned so much money in the past was because they had a lot of capital behind them. You know, if you think about it in a simplistic form, if you're going to dig a ditch and you have a shovel, I can't pay you as much as a guy who's digging a ditch with a bulldozer. Because the minute you put a man in a bulldozer, he's more productive. And it's the added capital that enables him to earn a higher wage. And just like, you know, I can pay somebody with a bulldozer more money than somebody who's digging with a teaspoon. Because that piece of equipment, I mean, not a bulldozer, a shovel. The guy with a shovel is going to be more productive than someone with a teaspoon. And so it's because of the capital that makes labor more productive that allows labor to be more highly compensated. The problem is, over the last generation or so, our capital has deteriorated. I mean, our factories have shut down. Our workers, because of our low savings rate and our high regulations, American workers don't have a lot of capital behind them. And as a lot of people are losing jobs in the service sector and in finance, and as they have to transfer into economically viable jobs, a lot of people are going to see that they're going to have to work for lower rates of pay. But ultimately, everybody would get a job if the government steps out of the market, and you know there will be a way for people to find employment. But if the government comes in and employs somebody, it doesn't mean that somebody is employed that would have been unemployed. It means that they're simply employed doing something that's not as economically viable as what they would have done had the government not stepped in. And, of course, the person might be overpaid. But if they are being overpaid, at whose expense are they being overpaid? At the expense of everybody else who doesn't get a cushy job from the government, or somebody who's thrown out of work because the money that would have been used to employ him is now diverted to the government. I mean, this is all a bunch of wishful thinking that people think the government can come in. I mean, it sounds very nice on the surface. Oh, this person is unemployed. Oh, the bridges need repair, so it makes perfect sense. Let's let the government hire these people to repair these bridges. Well, maybe the bridges need to be repaired and maybe they don't. And even if they do need to be repaired, repairing them is not a good thing. I mean, the fact that they need to be repaired, having them repaired is good, and the fact that they become repaired, but the act of repairing them doesn't help the economy. Certainly the economy would be better off if the bridges didn't need to be repaired, if they were already in good working order. The fact that we have to devote scarce resources towards fixing our roads or bridges is not a positive thing. Now, maybe we have to do it, but the fact of doing the work doesn't make us better off as a society, and it's not going to cause the economy to recover. You know, I saw today for some company, and they were, I think it was a way to make phone calls cheaper. And they said it was an economic stimulus plan because they saved you money and then you can go out and buy other things, and it was going to stimulate the economy. And you just get this consensus of opinion. I mean, everyone I talked to, that somehow going to the store and buying things stimulates the economy. I mean, it doesn't stimulate anything. It's pure consumption. I mean, what stimulates consumption is production. If you don't produce, then you can't consume. Now, what's happening in America is we get to consume what other people produce. But the problem is we can't pay for that stuff. And so we get all the fun, the consumption, and the rest of the world just gets stuck with a bill. And they have to do all the hard work. And it's not going to improve the economy if the government puts people to work. It's all nonsense. And, you know, today we came out, the savings rate, of course, the way the government reports it, was up about 2%. It's still ridiculously low. But that savings rate's going to have to get north of 10%, I think. And it's going to have to stay there for a long time. Americans have a lot of money to save. We have, you know, we've had years and years where we didn't save anything. You know, people just assumed that stock market appreciation or real estate appreciation was going to take care of it all. Well, now people are realizing that that's not the truth. And things are going to have to change, you know, for our whole economy. Again, you know, the world is looking at us now through a much more skeptical prism, not only because of what happened with, you know, the mortgages, but now what's happening with Bernie Madoff and this $50 billion Ponzi scheme. Here's another scheme pulled off by American. An American conned the rest of the world. You had this French money manager who committed suicide here in New York because he had $1.5 billion of his European clients' money in Madoff's fund. And, you know, eventually the world's going to put two and two together and figure out that it's not just Bernie Madoff that's running a Ponzi scheme, but, you know, the entire U.S. economy, the U.S. government. We're all one giant Ponzi scheme. And, you know, it only lasts until the world figures it out. You know, until the world figures it out, that the minute they stop lending us money, the whole thing falls apart. The minute the Chinese or the Japanese want their money back, the minute they want to cash in their treasuries, you know, we're going to have to come clean just like Madoff and say there's no money here. You know, Madoff was in great shape as long as nobody wanted their money back. Well, you know, we're in great shape as long as nobody wants their money back. As long as the world will lend us money indefinitely, and continue to lend us more and more and never ask for any of their money back, we can continue to pull off the same type of Ponzi scheme as Madoff did. And Madoff could have been going for years and years and years if people didn't want their money back. It just so happened that people needed money and they called up to redeem it and it wasn't there. And, you know, if we get the same call, if the Chinese call up, you know, Henry Paulson and say, you know, Henry, I need to cash in about $500 billion of my treasury bills, what are we going to say? There's nothing there. Now, sure, we can print up the money, but I mean, you know, but that's not the same thing as paying it off. I mean, the dollar will absolutely implode. Now, if you look at what's happening with the dollar, I mean, the dollar recently has starting to roll over. It had that huge, huge drop. And after that, it had a couple of, you know, days it snapped back. But the dollar index went from 89 down to 78-ish. And now it's back at around 81, high 81s. But it's still substantially below the levels that it was trading at for a few weeks. And I still think technically it's broken down. And it looks like the dollar is going to continue and make a new low. But people are still just so somehow optimistic that Barack Obama is going to come in here with this huge new government plan. Now they're talking about, you know, a $700 or $1 trillion stimulus plan on top of the, you know, $850 billion plan they already passed, which was that $700 billion for the TARP for the troubled asset protection and the extra $150 billion of pork they threw onto it. And now this is another, you know, $1 trillion. And, you know, it's just amazing, and nobody is starting to question what this cost. Everybody says, well, we've got to pay it. There's no choice. We have to spend this money. You know, I was just having a conversation with, I have a six-year-old son, and it was funny because he said to me, he said, Dad, he says, you know how when you go to college and you got to pick what you want to be? You know, you got to pick if you want to be a fireman or a policeman or someone who built houses. He said, do I really have to pick what I want to be? That's funny that he's six and he's worried about trying to pick his career. And I tried to tell him, I said, well, you know, you don't actually have to pick it right then and there. But I said, you know, you have to have some kind of career, something that you're going to do for, you know, to earn a living, to make money. And then he said to me, he says, Dad, he says, if I get a job and I earn money, will all the money I earn belong to me? That was his question. Will all the money I earn belong to me? Now, of course, I told him yes. But when I said that, that's not what I thought, because I knew the money wouldn't belong to him. What I could have said to him is, well, Spencer, I'm sorry, but you're going to work very hard, but very little of the money is going to belong to you. It's going to belong to the government. It's going to belong to Citigroup. It's going to belong to General Motors. It's going to belong to AIG. It's going to belong to whoever got some kind of bailout or some kind of stimulus. I mean, that is basically what we're doing to our children, and we're actually doing it to ourselves. This is not something that we're going to put off for another generation. We're going to start to suffer the cost of these government bailouts and stimulus packages right now, within the next several years, because they're so huge, they're so expensive. There's absolutely no way around this. You're talking about, you know, such an enormous expenditure and such an enormous amount of money just being printed. And, you know, and the thing is, and the scary thing is, they're saying they're going to keep on doing this until the economy turns around. Now, I know that the more they interfere with the free market's attempt to rebalance this economy, the more they interfere with the reduction in spending and the resumption of savings, the more the government tries to force feed credit into the economy and force people to go even deeper into debt, either directly or through the government, and tries to force us to buy more stuff when that's the last thing we should be doing. The more they do that, the worse the economy is going to get. And so they're, as I said, they're putting us on a course for economic suicide and destruction, because they're going to have to keep on doing. They're going to do this $1 trillion stimulus when Barack Obama comes in, and what are they going to do 6 months later? A $2 trillion stimulus? And then what, a $3 or $4 trillion stimulus? The more they stimulate it, the worse it's going to be. And it still has, I have a hard time convincing, I talked to another reporter today from the New York Times, that we can't do anything. They keep saying, but how can we do nothing? How can we allow this, all people to lose their jobs? How can we allow this to happen? Well, we just don't have a choice. You know, sometimes bad things have to happen, and you just have to accept it, you know, which is what this is. This recession is the consequence of the what we did, of the malinvestments, of the bad monetary and fiscal policy, of the consumption binge, of the reckless borrowing and spending of a generation. There's no way around it. Just because it's painful and it's not fun doesn't mean that the government can do something about it. Now, is it true that some of the things that they're doing might postpone the pain a little bit? Yeah, it'll postpone it a little bit, but then it's going to make it worse. Now we've even got a worse situation on our hands. You know, anything the government does, right, to postpone the pain means that we spend more money. We go deeper into debt. And so whatever problem we have now, whatever pain the government is trying to save us from, they're only making it worse. Because now, if we're in trouble because we spent and borrowed too much money, well, if we spend and borrow even more to postpone the pain, now where are we? Now we're in a deeper hole. Now we got even more pain. And the thing is, they can't postpone it indefinitely, because at some point it blows up. At some point you get the hyperinflation, and it doesn't matter how much money the government prints, because it doesn't have any value. It doesn't matter how much they give us, we can't buy anything with it. And that's the ultimate result. And of course, if we want to avoid that outcome, then the government's got to turn on a dime, and we've got to experience all the pain that they tried to save us from, only much more of it, because in postponing the pain, they simply made the balances bigger, made the problems worse. Anyway, I know people are waiting on hold, so let me figure out who's been on hold the longest. Let me go for Ellen in New York.
Who?
Ellen.
Oh, good. Sorry, I didn't hear you say my name. I've been reading a great deal where what we're doing now is being compared to what Japan did during the 90s. Mm-hmm. And so my question is, if we're doing what Japan did, why did they get deflation while you're insisting we're going to get hyperinflation?
Well, there's a big difference. I mean, the similarity between what we did and what Japan did is that the government in both cases interfered with the natural forces of the market. And so the Japanese government, by interfering with that recession, really exacerbated the problems. And they created this lost decade in Japan. It didn't have to be that way. I mean, Japan had a bubble. They had a bubble in real estate and stocks, just like we did. I think ours was bigger, but they had a bubble. The bubble burst. And rather than allowing the bankruptcies and the failures, the Japanese government interfered and tried to prop up companies and changed accounting rules. And they created what people used to call these zombie companies that were alive that really shouldn't have been. And they interfered. And the government spent a lot of money. They borrowed a lot of money to prime the pump in a Keynesian solution. But the difference is, the Japanese public had enormous domestic savings. They have one of the highest savings rates in the world. In addition, the Japanese were the world's wealthiest creditor nation, with the largest trade surpluses and current account surpluses in the world. So the Japanese were so rich, their economy was so fundamentally sound, that they could afford all the foolish government policies, that they could absorb it all. They would have been better off without it, but they had the savings. The Japanese people themselves had the money to loan to the government. The government, of course, blew the money. It would have been better had the government not borrowed this money and that money been invested more productively, but instead it was squandered by the government. And so the whole recovery was postponed or put off because the government was interfering. Meantime, now the Japanese national debt is huge compared to what it was before, and they wasted all that money. But they had the money to waste. The main difference is we don't have the money to waste. We're broke.
Right.
Okay, we had a bubble in stocks and real estate, but our bubble was financed by borrowing money from everybody else. Mm-hmm. The Japanese financed their bubble themselves. And meanwhile, now we're broke. We have no domestic savings. We have a huge current account. We have a huge trade deficit. The only way that we can finance a massive increase in government spending is to borrow the money from China and Japan and the rest of the world. Japan didn't have to do that. Japan didn't have to borrow from anybody. They had the money. Now, I don't think the world is going to loan us all this money. So the only other way to get it is for Ben Bernanke to print it. They didn't have to do that in Japan. They didn't have to print money. The Japanese people had savings. They just took that savings that they could have been used for something else. We're going to have to print it. And so we're the exact opposite of Japan. If you think about what Japan had, they were the world's biggest creditor with a high savings rate. We're the world's biggest debtor with no savings rate. So we're the opposite of Japan. We couldn't be more opposite. So we're going to have the opposite of Japan. We're going to have massive inflation. Japan didn't have it. We will.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. Thanks for calling. Next caller is Darren in Idaho.
Hey, Peter. I had a couple questions, if that's okay.
Sure.
I think I've heard you quoted as saying you believe the bond market is the next big bubble to burst, and when it does, that interest rates will in turn go through the roof. I know it's probably unfair to ask, you know, when you think this will happen, but given that Bernanke is behind the wheel, how high do you think rates will eventually get? When they start their ascent, how quickly do you think it will, you know, happen?
Well,
gradually,
you know,
or pretty rapidly?
There's no way to know, but I think what is going to happen, you see, the Federal Reserve is buying all the treasuries. And even if inflation gets worse and worse and the dollar keeps falling, as long as the Fed has got a bid in the treasury market, mm-hmm. it could keep those rates low. But the only rates that are going to stay low are going to be the government rates. The mm-hmm. rates on all the paper that the government isn't buying are going to start to skyrocket. And you're really going to start to see the spreads get even wider and wider between what the government can borrow at and what everybody else can borrow at. Because as inflation is driving down the value of the dollar, nobody is going to want to buy mortgages. No one's going to want to buy, unless, of course, the government is guaranteeing, which they are. But no one's going to want to buy corporate bonds. No one's going to want to buy anything that has an interest rate of 5 or 10% if inflation is 20 or 30 or 40%. So you're going to start to see interest rates for the private sector, for state governments, for municipalities, going through the roof. The treasury yields might not move as much because if the Fed is buying it all and they can print unlimited amounts of money, then they can buy as much as they want. But at some point, no one else will buy them. There won't be a single private person in the world who would buy a treasury. The only buyer will be the Federal Reserve, in which case it doesn't matter that the Fed can borrow cheap because no one's going to want their money. The money is going to collapse in value. Now, at some point, if the government does the right thing, they're going to have to dramatically increase interest rates in the short-term rates, like other countries do, when they have to raise their interest rates to 100%, 1,000%, when they have to do something to stabilize the collapse in their currency. But if the U.S. government just basically takes the position that we don't care if the U.S. currency is completely worthless, then they can print money all they want, and they can keep U.S. interest rates really low, but it's not going to matter. It's not going to do anybody any good because no one is going to be able to borrow at those low rates. And even if the government is able to borrow, what difference is it going to make? Because the money is not going to have any value. I mean, you can borrow and spend money all day long if you can't buy anything with it. What good is it going to do you?
So how high do you think they'll get, and how quickly do you think it'll happen?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I know that nobody is buying 30-year government bonds paying 2.5%. You'd have to be the biggest idiot in the world to buy U.S. treasuries and think that you're going to collect coupons for the next 30 years at 2.5% and that you've made yourself a good investment. So it's got to be the Federal Reserve that's buying, or it's got to be central banks. Nobody could be doing this with their own money. Now, there could be some kind of weird hedge strategies going on or some kind of speculative money that is just speculating on short-term momentum, but we know that money's got one foot out the door. I mean, they're not buying the bonds to hold them for 30 years. They're buying them looking to sell at a profit. So anyone who's buying now as a speculator is looking to get out. So they're future sellers, you know, even though they're buying today. But look, I mean, it is a huge, gigantic bubble, and it will burst. But, you know, when it does, you know, the implications are enormous. And if it never bursts, then it's even worse. Because the only way to keep it from bursting is to destroy the dollar completely.
Mm. Thanks. Okay. Just one last quick question. I absolutely agree with your grim assessment on the dollar's future. When it does tank, how long do you think it will take for the rest of the world's economies to shake off the effects, you know, rebound?
And I don't know. I mean, that's what's happening now. You know, it was interesting. Somebody put up, I think somebody was interviewed, it was on, I saw it on YouTube or one of these things, where a guy, I think it was from Kiplinger or somebody else, and they said, well, who made the best call of 2008? And the guy said, well, that would be Peter Schiff. He totally nailed the credit crisis. He went on and on about how great. And then later on in the clip, he said, okay, well, who made the worst call? He said, well, I guess that would have to be Peter Schiff again. And my worst call, that he said, was decoupling. He said, Peter Schiff said that there would be decoupling, and it's obviously not happening. Well, if you actually look at how I described it, if you read in Crash Proof what I wrote was going to happen, I said that initially when the U.S. collapse begins and we stop consuming, and when you see this initial collapse, I said the initial reaction outside the United States is going to be that foreign markets and foreign economies will turn down in sympathy because people are going to make the wrong conclusion. People are going to assume that since the U.S. is collapsing and we're not consuming anymore, that the whole world economy is in trouble. I said that. I wrote that that would happen. And I wrote that initially you would see declines in stocks, particularly companies that exported a lot to the United States. But what I said was when that happens, be prepared to buy. And that's why I have the chapter on liquidity, because I said if that happens and you get these opportunities, it won't last long. Because I think I said it won't take the world that long to figure out the real situation. And that just because the American consumer has died, they're going to figure out that consumers all around the world have been born to replace them. The one thing that's holding up that transition that I didn't forecast is the U.S. dollar. My assumption was that the dollar would be falling as our economic collapse unfolded. Instead, we had a sidetrack where the dollar rallied initially. And so that's keeping those forces at bay. But once the dollar starts to really fall, which is something that it has to do, that will make it easier for the world to figure this out and put two and two together. And I don't think it's that much further into the future. Whether it's a few more months or another year, it's hard to say. But I think once that happens and the dollar really starts to collapse and purchasing power is exploding all around the world, they'll figure it out. And so decoupling is going to happen. You know, it might not be happening exactly the way it might, you know, the way I thought is that the dollar is falling first, rising instead of falling. Although part of the problem is the dollar fell so much in advance of this crisis that by the time the crisis began to unfold, the dollar might have been ripe for a bounce anyway. I'm surprised that it bounced to the degree that it did, but, you know, I mean, these are crazy times. I mean, look at how much oil prices came down. I mean, oil came down from almost $150 a barrel down. It's trading at $37 a barrel right now. I mean, I expected oil to pull back from its highs, but I never expected it to pull all the way back to $37. I don't think that many people did. But I don't think it's going to stay here. I don't think it's going to stay here very long at all.
Yeah. All right. Hey, thank you. I appreciate it.
Sure. The next caller is that Ross in California?
Yes, it is.
Hey, Ross.
How are you, Peter?
Good.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. I have a couple quick questions for you. I know we're down on the bond market. My family is invested a lot in California municipal bonds. How do you feel about those, and what should we do about that?
Well, I would sell them. I mean, I would not want to own municipal bonds. First of all, Schwarzenegger is basically already going to the government asking for a bailout. I mean, California is basically broke. And, you know, their economy was very much dependent in California on the real estate bubble. So much of California's economy was either directly related to real estate, such as real estate sales, real estate finance, home building, home remodeling. A lot of the merchandise that was purchased, you know, new furniture, you know, a lot of stuff was done, television, appliances, things for the home. But also because so many people in California had so much home equity for a while, they were flush and they went to restaurants more often. They did a lot of things based on their home equity. Also, a lot of people in California had teaser rates. And so for a while they had mortgage rates that were subsidized, that were artificially low. And so that gave them added purchasing power. Well, all that is going away. And the government, during this real estate boom and consumption boom, the bureaucracy in California really grew and grew and grew, and they got used to all this money coming in from all sorts of sources. And now those the funds are drying up, and the government is broke, and it's going to get worse. And so I think you're going to see bankruptcies. And so what's going to have to happen, the only way you're going to get your money back on those muni bonds in California is if California gets a government bailout from Barack Obama. Now, maybe they will. But where is Barack Obama going to get the money to bail out California? Well, just where he gets all his money. Ben Bernanke is going to print it up. There's only two things that can happen then if you own these muni bonds. Either the government's going to default and you're not going to get your money back, or they're not going to default and you're going to get wiped out to massive inflation. So either way, there's no reason to own these bonds. It makes no sense, especially when you can cash them in and you can go and invest around the world and take advantage of the fire sale that's still going on. Even though a lot of the stocks that I've been recommending to clients, a lot of them are now 50% or more above the lows that they traded at a few weeks ago. They're still ridiculously cheap. And there are still some stocks that are 10 to 20% from their lows. I mean, they're still near the bottom. There are plenty of stocks you can buy, you know, with 10 and 15 and 20% dividend yields. I mean, why would you not want to buy those? Instead, buy a muni bond, you know, yielding 4 or 5% that's probably going to default or get destroyed by inflation. I think that this is such a great time to have cash, to have money to invest, because the bargains that are out there are bargains that we'll probably never see again.
Right. Our money can be invested elsewhere to make much more money. Another quick question about uranium. At the Hard Asset Conference in San Francisco, there was a lot of – I felt like there was a lot of momentum about uranium stocks, especially now. Some of them are off 90% this year.
Well, some of them are off more than that, yeah. And you remember uranium, the big play on uranium was that, well, oil was so expensive, there was going to be a bigger push to nuclear. And, of course, now that oil is $37 a barrel, you know, a lot of those new power plants, you know, those plants could be on hold. But, yeah, I think that uranium is going to make a comeback. It's just hard to know exactly when. But the biggest uranium stocks, you know, even the biggest one, like a Cameco, is down dramatically. All the juniors, all the ones that a lot of the hot money came into when a year ago or 2 years ago when Jim Cramer on CNBC started touting uranium stocks, I mean, that was the top.
Yeah. Whenever he says something, I usually like to go the other way. My last question is something a little bit more historical based. Have you ever heard of the book Tragedy and Hope by Dr. Quigley?
No.
Basically, Dr. Quigley was a professor at Harvard, Georgetown. He did massive research on central banks and central banking around the world, and basically came down to the conclusion that a lot of the central banks, as we know, our Federal Reserve is privately owned, and many of the other central banks around the world are privately owned too. And if that's the case, how does that play into some of the, you know, some of the economic problems that we're in today?
You know, there are a lot of problems as a result of the Federal Reserve. I mean, certainly we'd be better off had we never created a Federal Reserve and we just stayed on the constitutional gold standard. But, you know, had we not created the Federal Reserve, we might have created something else, or we might have just simply allowed Congress to print money directly as opposed to having it done through a central bank. And maybe they would have even done an even worse job. But anyway, thanks for the calls. I want to hop. I've got other people holding.
Thank you, Peter.
I didn't realize I have Mike calling from Tokyo, Japan. Sorry about the long wait on hold. Are you there, Mike? Is Mike there?
Yeah. Hello? Hello?
Yes, Mike. You're on the air with Peter Schiff.
Okay. Hi, Peter. Basically, I hear lots of talk about everyone comparing Japan to the U.S. or the U.S. to Japan and what's going on. And, of course, I realize that the comparison isn't exact, as you mentioned before. But I'm wondering what you think the outlook is for Japan. I know Asia is going to bounce back after this little, this little bump here. But Japan really isn't in Asia, and it's very attached to the hip to the U.S. So I'm wondering if you look at Japan and what your opinions are there.
Yeah, I think the stock market has come back down to its lows, where we're at 18-year lows or so in Japanese stocks. I think there's value there. I think that the Japanese economy, you know, is still sound. I think that The exports that Japan loses to the United States could be more than made up for by exports to the Chinese, and the Chinese will actually be able to make products that they can give to the Japanese, and it won't be just a charity, a one-way street. I think to the extent that the Japanese have been conned by the United States into propping up our economy, into propping up our currency, because they think that their success lies in exporting profit products to us, despite the fact that we have no means to pay for those products. I mean, it's unfortunate that they fell for that con, but I think that they're close to realizing that they really have been patsies. And I do think that we are on the verge of a major, major, economic global renaissance, that as the world reclaims their wealth and their resources and their savings and just forgets about the United States, I think that you're going to see, rising living standards and booming economies, particularly in the Asian region. And so I think Japan is going to be able to participate there and take part in that and benefit from it.
All right. That's good to hear. But, basically, I founded my company last year with a loan that I borrowed in dollars, which is nice now because I make all my money in yen, right?
Uh-huh.
But still, there's lots of nervous people around these days in Tokyo. And I've noticed even I just go outside and at night, and really there's no one out in the last weeks. So you can definitely feel the tension.
Yeah. Now, what the world has to do, though, is stop following the United States' lead in cutting interest rates. And the rest of the world, the reason that the Japanese can't raise their interest rates is because they don't want to destroy the dollar. But Japan needs higher interest rates. Rates are much too low in Japan.
Yeah, they cut it again last week.
They cut it again last week
to 0.1% from 0.3%, and now they're talking about raising the sales tax.
Yeah,
in fact, 10%.
If people, if Japanese have very high rate of savings in Japan, if the Japanese government would merely restore a normal interest rate, I mean, think about the benefits to the Japanese. They'd be earning a much higher rate of return on their savings.
Yeah, they don't earn anything on it now, and it's a testament to the Japanese that they even still manage to save despite being.
Well, it's almost like they have to save so much because their savings does so little. It's almost like the opposite. It's like maybe if interest rates were 5 or 6 or 7%, they would spend a little bit more because they wouldn't need as much savings because they could get a higher rate of income on a smaller quantity of savings.
That's also true. Also true. Okay.
But I know that, look, the rates are too low, and it's we are poisoning this because it's America that needs low interest rates because we're the debtor.
Yeah.
We have to pay all these low interest rates.
Yeah, and if the Japanese think they're going to get paid back, they're nuts. But
well, look, they're going to get paid back just like Bernie Madoff's clients were going to get paid back. everything was great as long as they didn't want their money, and everything is great as long as China, as long as Japan, as long as Saudi Arabia, as long as Germany, as long as nobody wants their money back, then this whole Ponzi scheme can keep on going. But the minute somebody in the world actually wants to get paid, they actually want to cash in their dollars and buy something, that's when the Ponzi scheme is over.
Well, thanks for the input, Peter. I appreciate it.
All right, great. Thanks for the call.
Keep looking at Japan.
Okay. Bye-bye. It's interesting. I actually went into a bookstore today and actually saw copies of my book. They had Crash Proof. It was in a Barnes & Noble, and Crash Proof was in the Business Week's bestseller list. There were several copies there, and they also had several copies of the little book in the bestseller new releases. So that was good. I know the books have been holding in there. They're still ranked in Amazon in investments, number one and number two, and they've been the number one and number two selling investment books on Amazon for about the last 2 months in a row. So actually, Crash Proof is selling better now, almost 2 years after it was released, than when it was a brand new book. If anybody's listening, if they haven't bought those books, make a point to do it. Let me grab Steve calling from Florida.
Hello?
Hey, Steve.
Hi. One of your big philosophies is getting out of the dollar. And, on one extreme, you'd have money in a bank or money market fund being terrible, And the other extreme would be, you know, owning a stock, you know, on like an Australian stock exchange. What about owning gold mining companies on U.S. exchanges? Because it is dollar denominated, but the, you know, the underlying asset is actually something that should go up during inflation.
Yeah, well, I mean, you can own gold stocks, you know, on any different exchange. I mean, you know, most of their mines, you know, might not necessarily be in the country that you're buying. I mean, you might buy a mining company in Canada, but all the mines are in Mexico. I mean, the bottom line is going to be the price of gold. Now, certainly, if you actually own a North American miner or a mining company whose mines are located in the United States, obviously, to the extent that the dollar declines in value relative to other currencies, then the cost of mining in the United States might be going down. Now, other factors, you know, could offset that, but in general, that's probably going to be the case. The main, and I own personally a lot of, mining companies in North America, some in the United States. The only fear that I have somewhat is that maybe there will be some nationalization or confiscation, you know, in the United States. I think there's, you know, people would say, well, that's not going to happen. People are normally, they worry about it in certain Latin American markets that the government might seize the gold mine. But, you know, we're going to be in such dire economic shape in this country that the government's going to act in ways that nobody thinks that they would act. I mean, the more their backs are to the wall, the deeper this economic crisis gets, the more of our rights are going to be surrendered, the more power they're going to usurp, and the more likely they are to seize gold mines in the national interest, because the government will be broke. The government will need hard money, hard currency, will need gold. If the government wants to try to maintain its empire, maintain its military, if the dollar is collapsing, how are they going to support it? So, you know, I wouldn't say don't buy anything in the United States, but bear in mind that there's risk. And make sure you have gold mining stocks in Canada. Make sure you have them in Australia, South Africa, Asia, other parts of the world, Latin America. You can own mining stocks around the world in case government somewhere decides to seize the assets.
Now, when do you mean to actually own them on the foreign exchanges?
Well, we own them on both. I mean, you can buy stocks. Now, a lot of Canadian companies are listed here in, you know, on the New York Stock Exchange. So you can buy, you know, a Canadian company in the United States. They're also duly listed. You can buy them in Canada. And it doesn't really make a difference which exchange is traded on. It's the same company.
But that's kind of my point, or my question is,
but you're not going to have any different performance. If somebody buys Barrick Gold on the Canadian exchange, and someone else buys Barrick Gold on the New York or wherever, the American, the performance is going to be identical. It doesn't matter. It's the same company. It doesn't matter where the shares are traded.
But it's denominated in dollars.
It's not denominated in anything. That's just how the shares are priced. The bottom line is the company is worth what it's earning, and the earnings are a function of the price of gold versus the cost of mining it. But if you list the shares of Barrick Gold in Germany, if you list them in Australia, if you list them in New York and Toronto, it doesn't matter the currencies that the shares are trading on their respective exchanges. The performance on the shares is going to be identical.
But I'm saying if I own, let's say, Newmont, or actually go back to your example, but I own it on a U.S. exchange and it's in dollars, and the dollar becomes...
It's not in dollars. Well, then the share price will be infinite. Remember, okay. I mean, yes, let's assume that the Canadian... Let's say the Canadian dollar loses half... The U.S. dollar loses half its value, and the price of gold stays exactly the same. All else is the same. Let's say that means the price of the stock in the U.S. will double, but the price of the stock in Canada will stay the same. But the real value is the same, because even though the price doubles in the U.S., it's still the same value, because it's only because the dollar has lost half its value. So you're in the exact same position whether you own the shares in Toronto in Canadian dollars or if you own them in the U.S. if the U.S. dollar loses half its value, because in the end you're going to have the same number of Canadian dollars either way.
Okay, that makes sense.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, another next call is from Devin up in Canada, in Ottawa.
Hey.
Hey, Devin, how are you?
Good, you, Peter?
I'm good.
What Asian currency will appreciate most versus the U.S. dollar?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I have a feeling that ultimately it'll be the Asian currencies. I mean, right now, those are the currencies where the governments are leaning against their currencies the most, where you have pegs or soft pegs. But ultimately, I think, you know, when the Chinese come to their senses and completely allow the currency to rise, you're going to see a spectacular rise in the RMB as well as many of the other currencies in Southeast Asia. I think that's where you're going to see the biggest gains.
Yeah.
Because that's where really you have the most productivity, you have the freest economies as far as economics. People are saving the most, they're working the hardest, they're producing the most. So that's where I think currency values really are out of whack, and they're much, much too low.
Yeah. One other thing, where do you think silver is going?
A lot higher. Definitely a lot higher. You know, how high, I don't know. I don't know how high it's going to go in terms of other currencies. I think in terms of the dollar, the rise is going to be spectacular. But the rise for just about every commodity will be spectacular when the government is, you know, printing money at the rate that we're going to do it. We're doing it now and what we're going to do in the future.
Yeah. All right, thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next caller is going to be Phil in Massachusetts.
Hello?
Hi, is this Phil?
Hi, Pete. I just have two questions. What do you see as the outlook for as a career for actuaries in the future?
Well, I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously, I think, you know, there's going to be more insurance and in that respect, and maybe, you know, maybe people will be looking for better information to better assess risks, and so maybe there could be more demand there. I mean, it's hard. It's really hard to say. I'm not as familiar with you know, how many people work in that area of insurance, and you know, I think financial services in general are going to contract, but I'm not exactly sure how it's going to affect actuaries.
Okay. And then another thing is, whenever you're talking about a recession or a boom, is your definition of what a recession is different than what, like, mainstream economists are? Like, what would you consider a recession for a
country?
Well,
a recession, most people are going to look at a recession, I guess, as a bad thing. And that's why it's something the government has to try to cure or try to resist or fight off with macroeconomic policy. And so people are just not understanding what the business cycle is and what brings it about. I mean, under normal circumstances, you're going to have, you know, somewhat of a boom and bust, but not very big booms and not very big busts in a normal free market. You're not going to have all these irrational decision-making simultaneously and reckless borrowing and you know, absent the central bank. And so what happens is when you get these booms that, you know, and everybody loves the booms, whether it was the dot-com boom or the real estate boom, because during those booms, everything is easy, everything is great. You know, we all get to have a great time. We get to spend a lot of money. You know, we get to live in the moment. We get to live carefree. You know, imagine, you know, you buy whatever you want. You don't have to save for the future. You don't have to save for a rainy day. You don't have to save for retirement. Why not? Because you're going to get rich owning a house, or you're going to get rich owning a dot-com stock. You know, you don't have to deny yourself anything. It's easy. It's fun. Everybody loves the boom. All kinds of, you know, crazy things are done. You know, it's like when you're drunk, and people are drunk, and they'll go out, and they'll do a lot of crazy things that they never would do when they were sober. And, of course, you know, no one likes to sober up and face the reality of all the crazy things they did when they were drunk. That's what the recession is. The recession is getting back to reality and having to deal with the consequences of what you did when you were drunk, when you were under the influence of a drug. And that's what we're dealing with now. We're coming back to reality, and we're having to realize that we squandered our wealth, that while we pretended we had a legitimate economy, all we were doing was blowing our money. And we're in serious trouble now as a result of all the things we did on the government alcohol. And so the recession is the cure, but the politicians and the government don't want it because, of course, they prefer the disease because the disease was fun. But so most people just do not understand what a business cycle is. They don't understand what a recession is. They don't understand what the boom was. They think that we just need to go back to the boom, and they don't understand that the reason we're in a recession was because of the boom. That the recession and whatever, however bad it is the consequences of the boom. And if we don't want recessions, then we can't have phony booms. And the only way not to have phony booms is to not have a central bank or not have the government artificially setting interest rates and printing money. We have to have interest rates determined by the market so that interest rates reflect the true amount of savings in society and so that business decisions and investments are made based on a legitimate interest rate, based on legitimate, you know, kind preferences for money and the savings available, and they're not, and we're not making investments based on the Fed, because that is the problem.
One more quick question. I've noticed some deflationists. They do say that they read your views to get a good perspective. Are there any people that you read that have an opposite view of, say, deflation that you get a perspective from?
Well, I don't know. People who think deflation, I mean, people don't even know what the term is. Deflation is a contraction of the money supply. We're not getting that. We're certainly getting defaults, debt defaults, and that is a deflationary act because it's a destruction of credit. But at the same time, credit is being destroyed, money is being created. And so I don't see that we're having a deflation. Now, a lot of people think that deflation is falling prices. That's not what deflation is. Deflation can result in falling prices, just like inflation can result in rising prices. Now, prices are definitely falling now, right? But it doesn't mean there's deflation. Why are prices falling? Prices are falling because companies are going out of business. Because companies have too much inventory, that they misjudged how much Americans can afford to buy, and now they have too much inventory, and they have to sell at a loss. Certain prices are dropping because of deleveraging, because people speculated with borrowed money, and they bet wrong, or they're having to pay back their loans. These are all temporary factors. Prices are not going to keep falling. Now, if prices were falling for good reasons, then that would be a good thing, right? Falling prices are a good thing when prices are falling because of improvements in efficiency, because of increased productivity. It's a good thing that cell phones are cheaper now than they were a few years ago. It's a good thing that televisions are cheaper now than they were a few years ago. I mean, according to these people who think falling prices are so bad, the government should have tried to stop that. They should try to prevent cell phone prices and laptop computer prices or plasma TV prices from falling. According to people who think that falling prices are bad, it's bad. We would be better off if television sets were more expensive now than they were in the past, if digital cameras were more expensive. Of course, it's all nonsense. But what's going to happen is right now we're having massive inflation. But prices are not rising because other factors are acting to push prices down, even as inflation would be acting to push prices up. But ultimately, all these temporary factors that are keeping prices down will be exhausted. And the only force we're going to have on prices is going to be inflation exerting an upward force. And prices are going to start to spiral out of control. But the government is jumping to the wrong conclusion. They're looking at prices falling now and assuming that that means there's no inflation and that they've got the green light to print money. They don't. Remember, they jumped to the exact same wrong conclusion back in 2001 and 2002 when they were trying to scare us with this bugaboo, this straw man of deflation, because they saw a weakening in the CPI, and that gave them the green light to slash interest rates down to 1%, and that's what enabled them to create the housing bubble and the phony economy, which is now blown up in our face, and we're all having to deal with the consequences of it.
All right. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call.
All right.
Next caller is John in Idaho.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Hey, John.
Hi, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. So I have four quick questions. The first one is, why do the other central banks need to reduce their rates in lockstep with the U.S.? Second question is, you said that countries need to be productive, but then, you know, places like Hong Kong or Singapore isn't very productive. So what about them? Are they going to collapse?
They still have surplus. So they have high savings rates, and they have things. They have services that they export. They also manufacture stuff too, but they have a lot of services that they're able to export. I mean, Singapore runs, I think, the largest per capita current account surplus in the world. I think these other countries are solid, and they have tremendous amounts of foreign reserves. They don't have to. I think the world is making a mistake. I don't think the world should be slashing interest rates. I think they're doing it only to keep their currencies from rising too much against the dollar, even as the dollar has been rising against some of these currencies. But I think the world is making a mistake, and I think ultimately they're going to have to raise interest rates because they are going to have to do something about the inflation genie that they are letting out of the bottle.
So what about
I think the U.S.
Like
Federal Reserve is going to be the center.
Most of their factories up to China, so they're not very productive now. There's mainly a service industry like the U.S.
No, they're not like the United States because they have a surplus. Singapore has they have a 50% savings rate, and they have a huge current account surplus. So even though they have a lot of services, they actually found a way to export those services and earn money.
What about Hong Kong?
Same thing. I mean, Hong Kong has a surplus too, and Hong Kong makes a lot of stuff. There's a lot of stuff going on there.
Okay, and my two other questions is, how can you explain, because this is textbook saying that, we still had a depression in the 30s while the U.S. was still on a gold standard. And my fourth point is, why do the U.S. borrow money from China and Japan where they can just print the money?
Well, if they just print it, it's pure inflation. If they can find a borrower, then it's not. You know, if the government can legitimately borrow money from third parties, that is not in itself inflationary. It's when the government can't borrow the money and they have to print the money that they debase the money. But the problem is that we can never pay the money back. And so ultimately it is inflationary because eventually our creditors are going to dump all those dollars back into the market when they realize how much they've been screwed. And that's going to happen.
Right. And that third question I had about why do we have a depression?
We had a depression because the government interfered with the market. I mean, you should read Murray Rothbard's book about the Great Depression or Amity Shale's book on the Forgotten Man. But the depression was a creation of government interfering in the marketplace, preventing free market forces from working to correct the imbalances that were built up during the 1920s and the new imbalances that were built up as a result of the policies that the government put in place. You know, the free market has to work. When it's allowed to work, then resources are allocated properly and efficiently, and people are not unemployed. People are able to find jobs. You know, wages are allowed to rise and fall so that people can be employed. But when you have the government fixing prices and distorting markets, they create shortages and surpluses. You know, they could create a surplus of workers, which means a lot of unemployment. Government regulation can prevent people from getting jobs that, absent regulation, they would have been able to find. I mean, governments distort the markets. I mean, why do you think, you know, socialist or communist countries have had such terrible economies and their people have suffered so much? You know, because their governments are stifling the free market forces that, in their absence, would have worked to raise the standard of living of their citizens.
So just having the gold standard alone doesn't do it.
No, I mean, look, just having a gold standard doesn't save you because governments can pass laws, governments can do things to distort the economy. Now, the reason we didn't have hyperinflation during the 1930s was because we were on a gold standard. We had some monetary discipline. We don't have that anymore. And that's the reason that the government is in a position to do far more damage now than then. Anyway, let me drop the call.
Thanks.
Let me take the last caller of the day very quickly. I think it's John. John, you got 1 minute. Are you on the air? I think we lost that caller. Anyway, let's not have any more calls. We're running out of time. Look, I want to thank everybody for listening on a Christmas Eve. I had a break. I have my Christmas dinner coming up in a couple minutes, and I don't even know if I have the Hanukkah candles with me where I am here today to light them. Forget what night it is, actually. But I'm sure a lot of people are going to end up listening to this in the archives or on the whatever that's called, where you can, I'm blanking on it, where you can listen to it, podcast. Yeah, a lot of people will listen to it on a podcast. Anyway, I think the next week looks like it's going to be an interesting week. I think we're going to see a resumption of the downtrend of the dollar. We'll see. It looks like it's rolling over to me. I don't know when the bottom is in oil. You know, I can't imagine it's going much lower than this, but I'm surprised that it's already gone as low as it has. But the other metals prices are looking pretty firm. Gold's still looking strong. I think silver's turning around. Anyway, that's it for today. I'll be back with you next week. Remember, it's www.europac.net, Wall Street Unspun, and you can call our offices, 800-727-7922. Good evening, everybody.